The Oakland A's are the defending American League champions and the favorites to win again this year. They've held first place in the American League West for the past couple of weeks and have the best winning percentage in baseball. My guest is the manager of the A's, Tony La Russa. Last year, he was voted Manager of the Year by the Baseball Writers Association of America. He was also given that honor in 1983 when he led the Chicago White Sox to the division championship. La Russa is one of only five managers in baseball history with a law degree. During his playing career, he was a utility infielder. He became the manager of the White Sox in 1979, was dismissed in July of 86, and signed with the A's just a few days later. I recorded an interview with Tony La Russa last week when Fresh Air visited San Francisco. The A's had won big on Monday, lost on Tuesday, and on Wednesday, the day we spoke, they were tied for first place. I asked La Russa what kind of talk he has with the team after they lose.
Well, it's a tricky thing. Talking to your players is tricky in the sense that if you have a formal meeting after every ball game that you lose, then you're going to wear out the effect of you meeting with the team.
Because
you play for 6 months, 162 games, and if you have a great year and you win 100 games, you're going to lose 62. So I think you have to be very careful when how many times you actually stand before the team and say, let's get together because I have something to say. What you do is more walk through the clubhouse. If you have a point, like last night, I thought we were a little sloppy in a couple of things. You walk through the clubhouse, you say it while they're out getting undressed, and you walk out. The next day is always a good thing to keep in mind because after a ball game, if you're upset, it may come out wrong. I try to watch that carefully because it's crucial. You can go in there and make a bad situation worse or you can do it properly. I noticed, for example, a guy that I respect a great deal, Roger Craig, who manages the Giants here. I think he's outstanding. They had about as heartbreaking a loss as you can have on Monday night when we were winning. And he was quoted as saying the worst thing he could have done was to go in the clubhouse and ripped his team apart because their heart was broken. They had played as hard as they could. They could have played better, but they couldn't have played harder. And that, to me, is a key thing. Terry, these guys are men, not machines. You look for effort first. And then you recognize that sometimes the execution's not going to be there because you just can't be perfect. So what Roger did was just, hey, we'll get them tomorrow. It was a tough loss. They came out yesterday, and I think they scored like 13 runs. So there's definitely a proper way to do it.
What do you tell a player who could have played harder?
Well, that's the one thing that you cannot tolerate. And if you make it a point of standing up before the team and saying something's important to you, then your credibility is at stake. So, for example, in my case, very clearly I state effort is the number one thing I look for day in and day out. So if you see somebody who shorts you the effort, not only is that person, your relationship with that person affected, but all the other teammates, they're watching. So if somebody gets by with not running a ball out or not getting the job done because they just physically didn't give you the effort, if you turn the other turn your cheek or ignore it, it's going to have an effect on the player and the whole team. So in effort, now, when it comes to effort, I usually treat that right now. I'll do it right during the game. I'll mention it. If for some reason something is distracting immediately after the game, usually in the privacy of my office, but if I think it's important enough, I think you have to confront a player right in the clubhouse.
In front of other players?
In front of other players. But that's a drastic one. I think if you nail a guy coming off the field in front of everybody in the dugout, it's got to be something severe.
I want to read you something that Bill James wrote about you back in 1984 in describing you as a manager. See what you think of this. Bill James wrote, Tony La Russa's strategy is calculated to play on the opposing team's mind, to disrupt them. He probably does that as effectively as any other manager. Do you think that describes you as a manager, as your strategy?
I think that's part of it.
How do you do it then? What's an example of disrupting the opposing team's mind?
Well, I just a lot of what I do as far as strategy is trying to remember when I played. So, as an example of what we try to do to disrupt the other team is more not necessarily disrupt, but just to keep them occupied. Last night we were losing 3-1. The number two run potentially got to base. Walter Weiss walked in the eighth inning. Tying run's not a bet. Normally, you don't do much with the guy on first base because you don't want to lose that runner and then lose the ability to tie the game with the guy at the plate. Well, we stole second, and then we stole third. Now Walter ended up scoring a sacrifice fly. It became a 3-2 game. We ended up not tying or winning that game. But the point was, from now on, when we play the Yankees or anybody else that was scouting us, they'll know. Even when they're behind, the A's will steal. So anytime that you put the thought of the steal in their minds, number one, the pitcher is a little bit leery of the game. The catcher is concerned. The infielders are moving around. When a guy gets to second base, for example, and they know, I mean, it's a stab. I think probably Bill James a couple years later would have said in 1988 or 87, the A's led the major leagues in stealing third base. So that means when you play against the A's and a guy gets to second, one of your two infielders, a second baseman and a shortstop, is going to have to shorten up and take the stolen base away. So when he does that, he opens up a hole for the hitter. And those are the kind of things I think that we try to do offensively and defensively. You know, just give the club a lot of looks and get them concerned, because it's too easy to play against us the other way.
Tony La Russa is my guest, manager of the Oakland A's. Let's talk about disciplining players, which is something that has to be a concern of yours as a manager. An example, Jose Canseco recently has had several problems in addition to his broken wrist. He was picked up for driving at 120 miles an hour. He picked up a friend at an airport who was carrying a loaded gun, and then Canseco's own loaded gun was found on the seat of his car. What kind of talk did you have with him about that afterwards?
I think you, as a manager, you have to separate the personal and the professional, whether it's your own personal and professional life, but especially here, players. In Jose's personal life, what he did this winter, going or not going to a card show, picking up a guy in the airport, driving fast, going to a doctor's appointment and having a gun in his car, that personal side, you have certain limitations as a manager as to what discipline and effect you can have. I think the number one thing you try to do is you try to establish respect and credibility with the player so that he'll come to you if he figures that he has a real problem or he hasn't got it covered. The professional side now, if he comes to the ballpark 30 minutes late, there's all kind of discipline that I can affect. If in a game he chooses to ignore my signal, you know, to run, to bunt, whatever, there's all kind of things I can do. If he chooses not to run hard, effort that we were talking about, you know, at the game now, one of my pet peeves is you read now about, and you know, I just read Roger Angel's New Yorker piece, you know, where there's this feeling among older baseball people that you just can't discipline players anymore. They do whatever they want to. That's baloney. Are the players today, yeah, in some situations a manager may let them get away with everything, but most managers still make them, you know, dot their I's and cross their T's. You can take their money. The argument is they're making so much money, so fines don't count. They still don't want to give the money up. You also have the power of the lineup card. You don't have to play them. Even Jose Canseco, if he is going crazy, not paying attention to signs, not hustling, we're better off with Jose sitting than having this great talent playing out of control. And last but not least, it's just a personal confrontation. I mean, these guys are just men, and they do not want to be challenged or embarrassed or directly told, hey, you know, you're really messing up and you're discrediting everything. So there's all kind of ways that you can discipline a player professionally, and I just think it's important that when you see a player like Jose or anybody, that when you see a problem, is it a professional problem, is it a personal problem, and you recognize that there are limitations as far as a manager or an organization when it gets to the personal side.
When we're talking about discipline, do you think that there should be kind of across-the-board rules that are applied to everybody on the team, or do you prefer to handle it on a case-by-case basis, depending on the temperament and the personality of the player who violated one of your rules?
That's a great question. Without specific examples, I'll do my best to answer it, and I'm not trying to straddle the fence. I think generally you have rules that apply across the board. I basically have two, three. Mm-hmm. Get to the park on time. Do not tolerate you being late. Give me your very best effort. And three, with that effort, try to play the game as good as you possibly can. Because this baseball is a game of execution and ideas. You just can't go out there crazy. You know, you have to play with ideas. So if somebody violates a rule and he's a veteran or he's a rookie, yes, generally they apply the same to all. But, you know, I take into account what's happening. if you have a veteran who's established that he's an outstanding pro and for some reason didn't run this ball out and has run every ball out his whole career, hey, come on, Carney, that's not you. I say Carney Lancer because he's on our club one of our best examples of a guy who plays his heart out. If he didn't run a ball out, you know, I know it's just an aberration, something that, you know, whatever, just he just blanked out for a second. That's not you. If you want to say anything, you don't have to. If a guy who hasn't established his reputation, I'm sure I would be more forceful and would not dodge anything. So I think generally you do apply it across the board, but, and here's a trick to it, I don't think that you can avoid trying to evaluate each situation and trying to figure out what's right here and there and then and now. And, you know, that may leave you open to some second guessing among the players. Well, you know, he's being inconsistent, but I think if you pay attention to what you're doing, you can be perfectly consistent and still be reasonable with the players.
Let me ask you about a few things very briefly. When you're in some kind of dispute or trying to discipline a player who's very high paid and getting paid a lot more money than you are, does it make it hard for you to have the kind of power and authority that you want in that situation?
Good question, and I think one that's very much misunderstood. The answer is absolutely not.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it used to be if I'd said that, well, how do you know for sure? Man, I've been doing it 10 years now. I know. Number one, I never talk to the player about money. Therefore, it's not an issue. I don't care if the guy's making $1 million, $2 million, or making, he's a rookie making 60. Never talk to him. The issue or whatever the problem is has to do with something on the field. So the relative salary between us has nothing to do with it. Second, I think I've learned, you are the manager. You are a man in authority. And if you are willing to take the authority and exert it, you will be paid the proper due. So, no, I don't think the salary difference has anything to do with it.
Let's talk about arguing with umpires. Something that all managers do. Something I think that you used to do more of than you do now.
Definitely. You came on early, you're trying to show the team that you're going to fight for them. You're trying to, you know, you're so anxious to have your club compete. And sometimes the umpires, they're there, they're convenient, and you take out your frustration on them. I think definitely over the years, I've definitely toned down. I've really realized it's a lot of wasted energy. I mean, these guys are out there, have probably the toughest job on the field every day, and I try to treat them with respect. You go out there for a legitimate argument, you argue quickly, and you get out. And basically, this is something I tell the team too, we're going to direct almost entirely all of our energies towards beating the other team. The umpire's not going to beat us, so let's not use them to get ourselves going, and let's not abuse them if you think, because they're not what's getting us beat. So I think over the last, I don't know, half dozen years or so, I think my relationship with the umpires has definitely improved, and it's something that I had to change because there's a better way to do it, and that's realizing just paying them the respect that they're due and concentrate on the opposing team and not the umpires.
When you do argue with an umpire, does your legal background ever come in handy?
Nah. Nothing comes in handy when you work with umpires.
Right.
There's nothing going to help. Early on, they would kid me about it a little bit because, you know, I had played for a long time in my leagues, so a lot of these men I knew. It was more a matter of kidding. But I got to say, basically, you go out there, if you have a legitimate argument, you say it quickly and you get out because you're not going to change anybody's mind.
Okay. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Tony La Russa, manager of the Oakland A's. This is Fresh Air. Tony La Russa is my guest, manager of the Oakland A's. Last year they made it to the World Series and La Russa was for the second time named Manager of the Year by the Baseball Writers Association of America. There's an old saying in baseball about how, you know what I'm going to say here, that the best managers are mediocre players usually make really good managers. And you were a mediocre player when you were
That's the kindest thing to say. I was worse than mediocre.
Well, I think your batting average was .200 for...
You just gave me 2 points about 198.
198, okay. So is there truth in that, do you think?
I think there's some truth in it, and I'm not making any claim about what I am as a manager, but I think there's no doubt in my mind that if you're a scuffling-type player that had to survive... in your scuffles, you would have had to learn a lot of the pieces of the game and play them to your max amount. You were not able to neglect base running or defensive positioning or the handling of, how pitchers are handled. Sometimes if you're a better player, if you're an outstanding hitter or something, or an outstanding pitcher, then you can just do your strength so well that pieces of it are not that necessary unless you personally make it a point to be a complete player. That, to me, is the formula. So if I look at a star, I know a star can be an outstanding manager, but did that star have enough interest in the total game to be involved and really want to be a great base runner? So if you see a player who does it all and really loves the game, well, just being a star doesn't mean he's not going to be a good manager. If you're not a good player to survive, you're forced to learn a lot about the game. And then when you get into it, I think, number one, you have those lessons. But number two, I think you do have, and here's probably the key call, Terry, I think you have a certain appreciation of the different ranks of players. I really believe that I understand what a guy who's struggling as a young player is trying to do, a bench player, a veteran player just coming off the peak of his years. So I'm not sure sometimes the star gets that appreciation unless he really is people interested.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that you were signed the night that you graduated from high school? Must have been some night.
Yes, it was. It was an exciting time for a young player back then because there was no draft. So it was back when anybody who was interested could court you. And at those days, there was 24 major league teams, and I had 20 contract offers of the 20. It was only four teams that did not express an interest. So it was, you had people coming in, they'd take you to dinner. They would, Charlie Finley personally flew down from Chicago to meet our family. So it was a very exciting, and it was, you thought, wow, if 20 clubs are interested, I must have some ability. And the fact was, graduation night when we came back to my parents' home, there were three scouts' cars parked outside waiting to talk to me about which club to go with.
Was it disappointing for you to have been courted the way you were and to be given so much money to sign with the A's and then to not fulfill that promise? Did you feel like a failure when you were starting in baseball?
My answer is no. I'll tell you why. It ended up being adversity that you grow with. There's no doubt. Everybody that has had any success will tell you they had adversity. They dealt with it. It made them stronger. And then later on, not only were they better for it, but they appreciated their success. So in my case, I was always injured. So to me, I can always, I don't talk about it much. But if push came to shove, if I had stayed healthy, I think I would have been a pretty good player. Mm-hmm. I hurt my arm, I hurt my back, it goes on and on and on. So if I had stayed healthy, I think I'd have been a reasonable major leaguer. But I wasn't. So my adversity was, and this is where I came out stronger, was I did not give in to the injuries. Now, if you look at my career from the 62 season that I signed through about 67, it was ridiculous. Was that five-year period, six-year period? I was hurt like four times in a major way. So what I learned about myself was that I wasn't a quitter, that I could play with pain, and that it meant enough to me to start something and finish something. So later on, as I started getting healthier, I ended up having some pretty decent years, especially in AAA, but I was then, I wouldn't say a fraction of what, but I couldn't throw very well anymore. My mobility was cut back, but I still played for 15 years. So when I quit, I knew that although my talents had been limited, I knew that I had some internal strength that I could deal with pain, and I wasn't a quitter.
We talk about pain and injuries. I think it was in 1963, the year that you were first signed. You injured your shoulder or a tendon while playing, and you didn't tell anybody. So you went through spring training without reporting the injury. And did you do permanent? Well, why didn't you tell anybody, first of all?
Well, I had a chance to make the major league team. It was one of those bonus baby provisions where if they want to keep you, they can choose to keep you on the big league team. And I knew I was one of the guys being considered. So I felt like I could fake it. The more that I threw with it, finally it ended up tearing. I had a tendon problem in my throwing shoulder, right arm, ended up tearing. But that was, I was just trying to survive at that point, and you're just not smart enough to realize, if I hurt my throwing arm as an infielder, it's not going to be very good for my career down the road. But, I never said I was smart.
So did you permanently injure?
Yes, even to this day, if I play catch, that one little spot right there is going to be sore. And what happened was, the rest of my career, I tried to adjust my throwing. They moved me to second base because it became pretty obvious that I, that I couldn't throw like I used to. And I started flipping the ball, so you end up affecting your elbow. I got chips in my elbow, and now you're an infielder that has a sore elbow and a sore shoulder. The only reason that I survived was that I ended up coping. You know, I got to where I was a very heady base runner. I ended up being a decent hitter. Yeah, I mean, I like you said, I hit 198 in the major league, but I was about 270 in the minor league. So even though I wasn't doing everything that you had to as an infielder to be outstanding at the big league level, I was still a productive minor league player. So, you know, later on when I started to manage, a lot of the stuff that I went through in the minor leagues and in my career really paid off in the sense that, I mean, I appreciated and I understood.
We probably tell players now not to go back on the field too soon.
That's one of the things that, I mean, we go through it all the time because, you know, guys are always coming up with problems. And I think it's pretty standard here. Like, you know, we have a guy currently, Tony Phillips, who's hitting 320 and technically has been about available to play. And as we tape this show, if you know, in my pocket here, I've got a card for tonight's lineup, and there's two guys at second base. It's Tony, one of them. He had an ankle, twisted his ankle the other day, and he's about ready to play, but I keep thinking about this, and if I don't play him tonight, it's just because of his ankle. And I can remember, I said, you know what's going to happen is this guy's going to re-injure it, so I'm very careful with injuries.
Tony La Russa is my guest, manager of the Oakland A's. You're one of only five managers in the history of baseball who also have had law degrees. When did you get yours?
Well, at the end of this mediocre playing career, you know, it was when it became obvious to me that I wasn't going to be a good major leaguer and make enough money to sustain my family, I got to do something else. And when I signed graduation night high school, you know, I signed this contract because my dad really wanted me to play pro ball, and I wanted to. My mother was very interested in education, so I said, Mom, I'll get that undergraduate degree. So I did. During the off season, I got my undergraduate degree there at University of South Florida in Tampa. Later in my life now, when I get to the end of baseball, I felt the other thing that I can do when I leave baseball is become a lawyer. You know, I love to read. I like solving problems, and I had friends who were lawyers. So I started going to law school during the off season, surely figuring that I was going to finish playing ball any one of these years, finish my law degree, become a lawyer. So I started in 73 and went every winter. It took me five winters. But what happened was about the end of the 76 winter season, the managing bug kind of bit me. So I was actually going to be a lawyer before I was going to be a manager.
Uh-huh.
And then it just, I figured, because of a combination of things, talked it over with my wife, Elaine. The day that I quit playing, it almost coincided with the day that I was going to graduate from law school. Why don't I take one shot to manage, get it out of my system? Because I had been a player coach under a great man named Lauren Babe, and he had kind of fueled my interest. So I tried to manage, and everything, I'm telling you, if I talk to you about my first few years managing, everything fell into place. I got to the big leagues very quickly, and therefore law became something that got shoved aside. But at one point, I was going to be a lawyer as soon as my playing career was over, but the managing thing, I just caught every break in the world.
Anything about law come in handy for you as a manager?
I think so. Here again, I'm careful when I say this because I've seen outstanding managers. You know, I think the best right now in our league is Sparky Anderson. And some of the things that he does, he didn't go to law school, so he learned his lesson, his places. And you look at other managers. But for me, I think the attention to detail and the preparation that they teach you in school will give you an edge in a case. I'm convinced, I've become convinced in my own mind that if I come into a series against a team, if I'm prepared in my own case down to the last detail, if the team is prepared, we'll have our best chance to win. So I think that's one carryover.
Any false assumptions made about you because you have a law degree?
Yeah, I think early on I had this giant, like, an anvil on my back. It's almost like people in baseball, because I was not a major leaguer for very much as a player. I think in the minor leagues, most people knew me as just, you know, a guy who loved baseball and played hard. But the major league level, when I got into major league managing, a lot of people who didn't really know me thought, hey, here's a guy that's getting publicity for being a lawyer. And they really, I think, misunderstood me. And so I definitely had to overcome that because, you know, I kind of resented it. Because there's no doubt in my mind that ever since 1962, so you count the years, more than half my life, I've been a professional baseball person, and I'm very proud of it. And for somebody to come and say, hey, he's a lawyer who's slumming as a baseball manager, really bothered me. And I think that stereotype took me several years to get by with baseball people. I think they finally realized, hey, this guy's just, that's just what he happened to do in the offseason, but he's basically a baseball man. And like I say, I'm very proud of it.
Let me ask you to remember one of your baseball memories from childhood, one of the things that really hooked you on the game.
Well, you know, most of them, I have three or four that come to mind real quickly. One, you know, I lived in Ybor City in Tampa, mm-hmm. Which was a hotbed of baseball, you know, kind of a Latin-Italian community, baseball all the time, so a very short walk to the park. They used to have come to call the Intersocial League, which is a semi-pro league, played on Thursday night and Sunday afternoon, and a real plum was being the scoreboard keeper. So, you know, they had a manual scoreboard in center field, and you sat in a wheelbarrow between the balls and the strikes. And because it was obvious that I loved the game when I was very young, they gave me that job. And you used to get, like, I believe it was $3 on Thursday night and $5 for the Sunday doubleheader. So one of my best memories was just sitting there in center field, you know, being the, you know, ball strike, get up and put the outs and put the score up and get to watch this game on Thursday night and the doubleheader on Sunday. And I'd always, on Sunday, then I'd go to the ballpark with my dad, who's, you know, would always follow me wherever I went. And then if it was a weekday, another memory that I have was, you know, we lived upstairs above a service station, and there was an alley, and my mom, because my dad worked all the time, my mom would play catch with me in the alley. So when I was real young, and you remember those things, and you know, and that's some of my strongest memories.
Tony La Russa, I want to thank you very much for talking with us about baseball in your life. Thank you.
Okay, Terry, thank you for having me.
Tony La Russa is the manager of the Oakland A's. They're currently in first place in the American League West. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.